Morning, Kate.
Good morning, Carl.
Good to hear you.
Good to hear you too.
And welcome to A Life in Biography.
Thank you.
I thought before we got into the specifics of your most recent book, the biography of Fannie Lou Hamer, you could tell us a little bit about your life in biography, how you got started on it, what appeals to you in the genre, and some of the other books you've done.
So, you know, when I was much younger, I used to collect antique diaries that I would find in antique stores and old bookstores. And I was mostly attracted to diaries of women from like the 19th and early 20th century. So I think that's what sparked my interest in biography. And in the early 90s, I decided to leave my job with an investment bank and go back to school and get a degree in women's history at Simmons University in Boston. And it just, that's how it evolved. My first biography was Harriet Tubman. And I just moved on from there. I think it's writing a biography is a great way to tell history, you know, to engage the reader in a historical moment in time, but through the eyes of the biographical subject. So I'm hooked. And so I hope that people are hooked on my version of historical events and history through the eyes of these women.
Why Harriet Tubman?
So when I started the master's program at Simmons, my daughter was 7 years old and in the second grade, and she came home with a little biography of Harriet Tubman. And I knew who Harriet Tubman was, but I didn't know that much about her. And because I was in this program and I was also taking African American history courses, and I just became intrigued by Tubman. So I looked for an adult biography of Tubman, and I discovered that there were two from the 19th century and one in the 20th century in 1943, and that was it. And my faculty advisors were stunned that there wasn't a modern biography of Harriet Tubman. So I started researching and went on to get my PhD and write my dissertation on her. And I just, you know, she just hooked me in after doing the research and finding her voice in the archives in New England. All those abolitionists that knew her, wrote about her, quoted her, they just marveled at her as a person. And I just wanted to know more about her and follow her life story.
I want to focus on Tubman for a moment. When your book came out, there were two other biographers who seemed to have gotten the same idea. You know, there hasn't been a recent biography of Harriet Tubman. And often when that happens, people say, well, they think of the life story as content, and it's going to be the same no matter who tells it. And of course, you know, and I know, that's hardly true.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter whether there have been six biographies or three biographies, or if the biographies are all appearing at once, I can guarantee you, just by who writes the biography is going to be different.
Right.
I wanted to point this out to listeners using your work. I'm reading from the review I wrote in the New York Sun of the, at that time, three Tubman biographies. And about this incident with James Brown, his raid on Harper's Ferry. And I'm not going to go into how the other biographers handle it, except to say, and I'm reading now from the review, they both accept the idea that at the crucial moment, Tubman was either ill, incommunicado, or somehow out of touch with Brown when he attacked Harper's Ferry. I go on to say, but Professor Larson envisions another Tubman. And now I'm quoting from your book. She may have decided that Brown's attack was doomed to failure. She probably knew he had few followers, leaving him incredibly vulnerable. Douglas, that is Frederick Douglass, had rejected Brown's scheme as unworkable, and perhaps Tubman too came to the same conclusion, and that it was better to feign illness than to endure Brown's disapproval. Her strong survival instinct may have protected her in the end. Nevertheless, her silence on this issue, even years later, may indicate a careful decision not to reveal the full extent of her participation in Brown's raid. Now, that's a fascinating paragraph to a biographer because of some of the words you use here, probably, perhaps, may. You're trying to think through how all this appeared to Tubman. I go on to say in my review, this passage is a remarkable instance of what one can learn from a biographer when she is speculating. Better than her two colleagues, Professor Larson has captured, in my view, Harriet Tubman's clandestine nature, so essential to her career as an intelligence operative. That's where biography strikes. And that's my reply to people say, well, how can you know? Or the evidence is conflicting. You follow patterns. You follow what the significance of your subject's life is and the sensibility of that subject.
Right. You know, we as biographers, we inhabit that space for so long. If you're doing your job and you're researching, you inhabit that person's space, so to speak. And I think we have to sometimes speculate when the words aren't there. Actually, even when the words are there, when they've spoken on a particular opinion or a moment in time, you know, we can't always take them at face value. So as a, you know, to do this for readers, for people who are interested, I think we have to sometimes explore what we understand about that person and present it to the reader. And with Tubman, certainly there were many things that she was not recorded as talking about. And having known her all those years as I was writing the biography and since that time, you know, it is her clandestine nature, her nature to keep things close to the vest, to watch and, you know, see that what is going on in that landscape, that human landscape, the physical landscape, and having that instinct about what to do next. And it protected her clearly. And so I don't think I was off the mark in speculating about what may have happened when she did not join John Brown on that raid.
I think that's right. And I was really so inspired by her book. I started thinking, I think like Harriet Tubman too, or so I thought, you know, this woman could have been the first head of the CIA.
That's so interesting because I don't know if you're aware, but in June, she was inducted into the United States Army Military Intelligence Corps Hall of Fame as a full member. And the general that did the ceremony and inducted her into the hall, which is at Fort Huachuca in Arizona, he said that he looks at her as one of the first special ops officers in the military.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, given the kind of danger she faced, the ground that she had to traverse, she's just a tremendous figure.
She is. And I think there's still more to know about her and explore and understand about her. That's the gift about Harriet Tubman. I think there's always something more to see over time about her life and her contributions.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think as time goes by, we see and we value things that people at the time or even subsequent biographers didn't see or weren't prepared to see.
Right, right.
So how do you get to Fannie Lou Hamer?
You know, it was a circuitous route, but then again, maybe if I look at it, it's sort of a straight line. You know, I learned about Hamer back in my graduate school days, and she always stuck with me. She was always in the back of my mind. And, you know, I went on to other projects and I work as a consultant and I was teaching for a while. So she just stayed in the back of my mind. And when I was thinking about the Rosemary Kennedy book, I talked to my agent about Fannie Lou Hamer, and she felt that I wasn't ready to take on Fannie Lou Hamer. And she was right. I think she was right. And in the meantime, the Rosemary Kennedy book just kind of, you know, I had to do it. So, but when that book came out and that was done, I went back to my agent and she said, yeah, I think you're ready now. And what a journey it's been to research her life. So in so many ways, it makes sense because to me, she is so much like Harriet Tubman. Something about that character, profoundly spiritual person who faced incredible obstacles and discrimination and racism, and how she persevered and triumphed in many ways, at great cost to herself. There were just so many similarities. So I was comfortable writing about her. I didn't have any qualms about it. And the research, wow, so many things have opened up since a lot of the biographies were written in the 1990s and early 2000s. And just going through that material, I couldn't stop. So even if my agent had said, I don't think you're ready, I would have gone ahead anyway.
Before we talk about the research, tell us where Fannie Lou Hamer came from and how she came to become the figure you would want to write a biography about.
So she was born in the Mississippi Delta in 1917, the 20th child in a family of sharecroppers. Her life was filled with tremendous poverty, and in Mississippi, the most racist state in the nation, they have the terrible distinction of having the most lynchings in this country. So she grew up in great poverty, great racism and discrimination, and lack of opportunity. But a very strong family, a strong mother figure who, you know, raised Fannie Lou to be a strong woman and to withstand the discrimination, the violence, the oppression. And she also was incredibly bright child, brilliant adult, very little education, unfortunately, because she had to go into the fields at a very young age to work, pick cotton with her family to earn enough money to survive. And but she was brilliant, and she was an observer of people and the environment. So in that way, she's very much like Tubman. And so she had these amazing survival skills, but she wanted the world to be a better place. And given the different circumstances and things that happened to her that she had no control over, for instance, she was sterilized without her consent, which just totally, it sent her in an entirely different direction in her life when she discovered that that had been done. When she had been expecting to be cured of fibroid tumors, she was given a hysterectomy and then could no longer have children of her own. She just took that rage, looked to her faith, and tried to make sense of it, and came out of it determined to really step up and make a difference. And in 1962 and 63, she moved forward with the civil rights movement, and based on her own being, her leadership skills emerged. And people in the movement, the national movement, recognized that, and she took everybody by storm and really rocked the world.
Now, you know, there's this cliche, speak of someone being beaten within the inch of their lives. Mm. She experienced that.
She did. In 1963, in June, she was arrested with several of her colleagues. They were coming back to Mississippi from South Carolina, where they had enrolled in a citizenship education class, where they learned how to teach ways to pass those incredibly awful voter registration literacy tests and things like that. And so she was arrested in Winona, Mississippi, and taken to jail. And she and the other women and a couple of the men were brutally beaten, but Hamer was sexually assaulted and brutally beaten, nearly killed. And I view that as a moment. She survived, and that's part of the title of my book, Walk With Me, when she was in her jail cell, barely surviving, and her cellmate was with her, and Fannie Lou Hamer asked her to sing the song Walk With Me, Jesus, so that she could endure the pain and help her survive. And she did survive. But she came out of that a changed woman. And she later said, you know, they've been trying to kill me all these years. You know, I'm going to do what I need to do to make a difference in the world. And if they kill me, then so be it. And it was after that beating that she came to that conclusion that she would continue to risk her life to bring equality and justice to African Americans.
I think her singing not only in that incident, but so often in her public appearances, was a kind of power that's incalculable in terms of reaching the human spirit. You know, you can give stirring speeches, you can move people with your words and your actions, but there's also something, as your biography describes her, her singing is just phenomenal.
It is, and I think that, so everybody talks about Hamer singing, but I want the audience to really understand the power of that voice in a crowd that is listening to speeches about voting rights and civil rights, etc. And when she would get up, she was a natural born speaker. She didn't have the most perfect diction like a Martin Luther King, but she had the ability to talk like a minister, and she had a rhythm to her speeches, and then she would segue into singing. And she, that those audiences, when you listen to those tapes of her speaking, those audiences, you can hear them, you can hear the energy, and then you can hear their voices, and they start a call and response back and forth to her, and then they just, everyone erupts in music, and they feel energized and encouraged and strong. It's exactly what she wanted, but she felt it too. They could feel her vibrations on that stage. She really was a remarkable, remarkable presence in the movement and talking to audiences.
There's something else that I was struck by in reading your book, and that is, of course, she faced, you know, terrible odds. Southern sheriffs, white people of all kinds, not just segregationists, but worse than that. Terrible. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that you show is the problems within the civil rights movement itself and some of the attitudes toward her. I wonder if you could talk about that a bit.
Sure. So within the movement, there were class issues. Hamer was a poor sharecropper, sixth grade education, and then other leaders in the movement in Mississippi and nationally, like the Martin Luther Kings and his colleagues, there was a tremendous cultural and class difference. And some of those leaders were embarrassed by Hamer. Her clothes were not the most stylish. Her, as I said, her diction was not perfect. She seemed too down home. She was heavy set. She perspired a lot. She didn't fit their image of what they wanted to portray to white America, basically. So she experienced tremendous discrimination from them. And also, as the movement matured during the 60s, like the younger people started getting impatient with older activists like Hamer, who were counseling, you know, just be patient. Not, she didn't counsel to be patient, but, you know, keep working hard and we can do this. And they were getting impatient. They wanted to strike back. They were tired of being beaten up and shot at and killed and abused. They wanted to fight back like the Black Panthers. And so they looked at her as old-fashioned and out of step with the future. So she was getting it age-wise, class-wise. It just was a difficult time for her. And eventually, you know, she was sidelined in some ways, and that was unfortunate. But that's the nature of movements. The people get pushed aside and new voices rise up and take over. And then also the movement began to fall apart, the Vietnam War, you know, sort of interfered with carrying that movement forward, and people aged out of it. A lot of the young people wanted to go back to college and graduate school, get law degrees, make a difference in public service in other ways. So it just, she kind of got left as the movement moved on and changed and then eventually sort of really disappeared.
You know, there's an irony here. When I think of Fannie Lou Hamer, I think of her nobility, her ability to, you know, rise above the most degrading, threatening conditions. And yet when we think of nobility, that is the way we're trained to think of it, someone might think of, say, like a gentleman hero like Ronald Coleman, for example, you know, the Hollywood example of, you know, in A Tale of Two Cities, you know, he says, a far, far better thing I do, you know, this sense of sacrifice. But it's all done so eloquently and with, you know, as you say, the proper diction. So here Fannie Lou Hamer comes along without the proper diction, and even in a sense, her own people, even certain civil rights leaders cannot see, cannot get beyond, I think, their sense of what, you know, the proper example should be. It's really just fascinating, someone reading your book, to see that. When you get into a biography, they see aspects of this person that you can connect with as a reader, even as others who you would think would connect with her reject her.
Right, right. And, you know, it's sad, but this is a fact of life in America anyway, and I'm sure other countries too. There are class divides, and it's hard to overlook those things. And, you know, and she, her voice resonated with average everyday Americans, Black and white, because she was not an elite. And she spoke the language of people who were oppressed, who were terrified and hungry every single day. And she spoke to people who were concerned about that, that they too wanted to see change. But for some of the elites, it didn't resonate, sadly. Even though they used her very effectively and she took advantage of that, it still posed a problem and it frustrated her. It makes me very sad. Those nights she probably reflected on her treatment by them, and it was very, very difficult. She did triumph in some ways. She got what she had hoped for in 1968 at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. The all-white Mississippi Democratic delegates were not seated, and her party, the Loyalists, which had combined with the Mississippi Democratic Freedom Party, they had triumphed, and they were seated instead, and Hamer received a standing ovation. So that was such a pinnacle for her. She had hoped that would happen in 1964. It did not. It was a painful 4 years, but she did triumph.
Yeah, she persisted. She really endured. Yeah. Say a little bit about her personal life. Her relationship with her husband is a complicated one.
It's very complicated. So she was married to Pap Hamer, Perry Hamer, in 1944. She had already married and divorced another man. And then she met Pap and married him. They adopted two girls, Dorothy and Virgie. Hamer had many fertility issues. She had a couple of stillbirths and miscarriages. They were sharecroppers on the Marlowe plantation together. They ran a little juke joint because they made moonshine. It was a dry state, but they kind of look the other way with people distilling liquor. And if you had food in your home and whatever, they look the other way. So they did this, and so that was part of their life together. But he had affairs, and that was a little shocking to me. But I had to write about it. It was a fact of their marriage, and he had children with other women as well. So, which must have been incredibly painful for Hamer, who could not have babies of her own, especially after she was sterilized. And so, you know, it's a complicated relationship, but there's no doubt they loved each other very much. And they stuck it out, and he stood behind her and vice versa. And as one of Hamer's relatives or her godson said to me, you know, you just can't know the interior of a marriage. And that's so true. We just can't know it. Yeah. We know the children that were born of his affairs, et cetera. But they stayed together, and it is what it is.
And he's remarkable. You know, there are a lot of men, especially in that period, but still today, where the wife, you know, becomes the, in a sense, successful one, the famous one, and the husband resents it. Mm-hmm. There leaves, or there's tremendous conflict over just that. And he seems to have made his peace with it and was very supportive.
Right.
In a lot of important ways.
Right. I think occasionally he would just check out.
Yeah.
But that was okay. She understood that. And, but, you know, I talked to one of their daughters, their granddaughter, and she said he was an amazing father. And the stories she told me were so touching. And, you know, he was there. He raised those girls when, you know, Hamer was off doing her speeches and traveling around the country raising money. And he was home raising their children and grandchildren.
Yeah. Say a little bit more about the research. You said you had, you know, material available to you that other biographers had not seen.
So, you know, these records, I have to give a shout out to the civil rights veterans out there who have organized websites. They're posting documents online, digitizing things, putting them online. There are archives opening up across the country. They're digitizing everything that they have so that, you know, people today can see the material and they're still living documents. There are still people alive those documents are talking about. So those things that were scattered resources are now ending up online. And also the government documents, the Sovereignty Commission papers, the from Mississippi, which was like Mississippi's own secret FBI, and then FBI records. Now, Hamer's FBI record, it's a strange thing. There are many things that are redacted in it, and I've asked for it to be unredacted. And because of COVID, that process stopped. But it turns out I didn't need her FBI record because everything that was redacted in it is actually unredacted in other people's FBI files that have been opened. So you can see the same page, the same document that's redacted in Hamer's file with a copy in someone else's file. I don't get that, but there you have it. and the King Center has been has tremendous archives. Those are all now online. And so I was able to piece together stories and that, you know, people wrote about 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but now with the actual documents, I'm seeing what happened behind the scenes, not what was reported in the newspapers, but who was saying what behind the scenes and how things unfolded and developed and who was doing what. And for instance, one of the documents is, so I discovered who sterilized Fannie Lou Hamer, which had been a mystery. Who was the doctor that sterilized her? Well, it was the mayor of Ruleville, Mississippi, where she lived, was Charles Doro. Well, his son was a doctor and he's the one that sterilized Fannie Lou Hamer. So this was in one of the documents that was kept by SNCC workers, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and COFO and all those other organizations. It was in those documents. And they were hoping to get women to testify against him. But all the women were afraid to stand up to a white doctor in Ruleville.
Yeah, it's understandable. Is there something I should have asked you about the book that I didn't get to?
No, I'm just hoping that people will read it. And also when I started writing this, I did not know, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that we would be in this moment in time right now in our country. And so the language that you're going to read in this book that was going on in the 50s and 60s, that language is being used today, the same kind of language about voting rights and restricting voting rights, what white supremacists were saying and doing. It's still here. It may have gone underground, sort of, but boy, it's full blown again. So people will recognize it. This is timely and timeless, unfortunately.
Yes, yeah. Do you have an idea of what's next?
I do. I'm not ready to talk about it yet.
That's usually the response to that question.
I need to do some more research and interviewing people before I make the commitment.
Sure, I understand. Well, this has been marvelous. I really enjoyed reading your book, learned a lot from it. And as usual, I admire your skills as a biographer.
Thank you so much. This has really been great. Thank you, Carl.
Thanks. I'm going to post this shortly and you'll get a link and we can let the whole world know.
All right. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yep. Bye.